Am I the only one who's kind of weirded out by the number of chemicals and cleaning products these days? So I started looking into what I was actually using around the house, and my laundry detergent turned out to be the worst offender. It's full of harsh chemicals like UV brighteners, dyes, and preservatives, which can wreck your skin or trigger allergic reactions. That's why I switched to EarthBreeze. It looks like a dryer sheet, but it's actually laundry detergent. Just toss a sheet into the washer with your clothes and that's it. No pouring, no mess, and no plastic jug. My laundry comes out fresh, soft, and clean without unnecessary chemicals. And right now, you can try EarthBreeze for up to 40% off with free gifts at earthbreeze.com/ATTWG. That's earthbreeze.com/ATTWG to get up to 40% off with free gifts on your first order. You are told your health starts in your gut. But if you're a woman, it all starts with your hormones. When your hormones are off, everything is off, including digestive issues, mood, mental clarity, energy levels, weight management, and so much more. As the new year approaches, imagine hitting refresh and supporting your body with optimal hormone balance. Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormonal imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance. Perfect for enjoying the holidays and heading into the new year energized. Happy Mammoth, the company behind this, has helped over 2.4 million women get their lives back and feel like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code ATTWG.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On a crisp winter day in 1910, a 25-year-old New York socialite left her family's Upper East Side home to buy a new evening gown and vanished without a trace. Over a century later, Dorothy Arnold's disappearance remains one of New York's greatest unsolved mysteries and its oldest missing persons case. Over the decades, there have been many theories about Dorothy's fate, everything from secret elopements and amnesia to botched surgeries and buried bodies. But despite widespread publicity, Dorothy has never been found. Did something tragic happen to her on that cold December day? Or did Dorothy Arnold simply choose a different path for herself? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. Today, I want to tell you the story of Dorothy Arnold. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home.
I think I might get you there.
How?
I think I might know some of the facts behind this case.
How do you know anything about this?
Because it's the oldest case of a missing person in New York.
So?
I don't know. I've heard the story before.
There's no way.
Yeah.
You don't know anything. You didn't know that Cindy Song went missing from your college while you were at that college.
That's not true. I didn't know all the facts, but I did remember that case.
I don't know. I think we need to roll it back. I don't think that's what you said at all. All right. Well, once we get into it, tell me if you think you know this, but I cannot imagine you do.
I think it came up in like some crim classes that I took in college.
I don't know.
Like I said, I don't remember a lot of the facts, but the story sounds familiar.
Okay. But yeah, it's one that I've been wanting to cover for a while. For those of you who listen to my other podcast, Day by Day True Crime Stories, this was our December 10th episode because that was the day she went missing. And so that was fun. But like, those are obviously very short episodes. So I really wanted to dig into it here because there are so many different theories about what could have happened to Dorothy. It's also one of the rare ones where she ran off to start a new life is actually like kind of viable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I thought it'd be a good way to cap off season 6 and 2025.
It's crazy that we've been doing this for 6 seasons.
I know, isn't it? 5.5 years right now.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Before we get started, though, we've had some new folks join us over on Patreon. So we want to take a moment to thank AKC, Molly C, Carrie, TT, Candace F, Megan K, Heather L, and Steph. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you all so much.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get these episodes without all those ads, you can join there at any level at Patreon, starting at just $2 a month. You'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. Now, with all of that finished, let's get to the story that you claim to know of Dorothy Arnold. Dorothy Harriet Camille Arnold was born on July 1st, 1885, into a life of affluence. Her father, Francis R. Arnold, was a Harvard-educated importer of fine goods and had made a considerable fortune as head of F.R. Arnold and Company. The Arnold family's social standing was unquestionable. They were listed in the Social Register of Elite Families and even boasted ties to a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Dorothy's aunt, who I believe was Francis's sister, was married to Justice Rufus Peckham, which is a justice I have never heard of before in my life. Dorothy's mother, Mary Martha Parks Arnold, hailed from a prominent Canadian family, and together the Arnolds raised 4 children in Manhattan high society. Dorothy was the second oldest, with an older brother, John, and 2 younger siblings, Dan and Marjorie. Dorothy was given the best education and social training that money could buy. She attended the exclusive Velton School for Girls in New York, then enrolled at Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania, where she studied literature and languages and graduated in 1905. Friends described Dorothy as cultured and refined. She was someone who enjoyed literary salons, theater, and high society gatherings. But Dorothy wasn't content to be just another debutante. She had ambitions of her own. She dreamed of becoming a writer.
I knew that. I feel like this entire episode is just going to be me saying, trying to prove to you that I know this story.
Yeah, by me telling you something and be like, yeah, I knew that. After college, Dorothy moved back into the family's mansion at 108 East 79th Street and set about pursuing a literary career. Now, this was a big deal because it simply wasn't something that a woman of her status in 1900s New York did. According to later accounts, her family found Dorothy's writing goals more amusing than admirable. Basically, they were kind of dicks to her about it.
Yeah.
In early 1910, she submitted a short story to McClure's magazine only to receive a rejection. Her relatives teased her about the failure to the point that Dorothy rented a post office box so they wouldn't see any more letters from publishers. I know, is that so sad?
Yeah.
But Dorothy didn't give up. She penned a second story titled The Poinsettia Flames and sent it off that November, but it too came back with a rejection slip. This second rejection hit Dorothy hard. Friends later said that she seemed dejected and humiliated by the setback. Dorothy was a woman who was used to getting what she wanted, but her dream of becoming a writer wasn't coming easily. Plus, her own family didn't take her seriously. Her dream of becoming a writer wasn't just about the writing either. It was part of a bigger dream to have a different life. She wanted to be more independent. She wanted to be a part of the vibrant art scene of Greenwich Village, not just visit it from her uptown mansion. In the fall of 1910, Dorothy did something bold. She asked her father if she could move out of the family home and get a small apartment downtown where she could write in peace.
Which I'm sure as a businessman, he was not too into the thought of her daughter, like, living in an apartment, being a hobo writer.
Yeah, exactly. You know? I mean, that just simply was not something you did. Like, you didn't move out without a husband, you know.
Right.
You stayed in your family home until you got married, and then you moved into your new family home. And
right.
That was it,
yeah.
You know. So, yeah, he obviously thought it was an outrageous request and told her, quote, a good writer can write anywhere, end quote.
Burn.
Yeah. Though Dorothy was always outwardly obedient toward her parents, she wasn't without her secrets. While she was at Bryn Mawr, she had met an older man, George S. Griscom Jr., the 42-year-old son of a wealthy Pittsburgh family. Jr., as he liked to be called, was a balding, sideburned engineer who still lived with his parents and lived off of the family wealth. And that was the thing. When I was looking into this for Day by Day, you know, I just read that he was like a 42-year-old bachelor. I didn't read until like I was, you know, looking at more sources for this that he was like fat and bald. Like, what are you doing, Dorothy?
Maybe she's got some daddy issues.
Yeah, maybe. So, yeah, whatever it was, despite of his flaws, because of his flaws, Dorothy started a relationship with him. But it grew serious, and by the summer of 1910, the two were talking about marriage. The Arnolds, upon learning of Griscom, were not thrilled. Francis and Mary Arnold found Griscom rather unsuitable. They didn't want their bright, beautiful 25-year-old daughter with an old bachelor with, quote, nothing to do, as Francis would later say.
But he comes from a wealthy family.
Yeah, but he wants him to, like, also have a job. You know, he doesn't want him to be some lazy asshole like living off of his parents, you know. So Francis, if I'm remembering correctly, was also born into wealth. But so, you know, he definitely had a leg up starting out in life. But he also found his own success as a businessman and made a lot more money than he started with, you know. So I think that's kind of more of what he wanted for his daughter. Like, he wanted somebody who came from money, but then he wanted somebody who also did something. So they forbade Dorothy from continuing the relationship.
Mm.
But, of course, Dorothy did not listen. In September 1910, she devised a plan to see Griscom in secret. And this, like, this whole story is wild to me. So she told her parents she was going to visit a college girlfriend, Theodora Bates, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for a week. So with her parents' permission, she set off. But instead of Cambridge, Dorothy slipped away to Boston, which is right next to Cambridge. And Griscom was there waiting for her. For one blissful week, Dorothy and Junior stayed together in Boston, openly dining and sightseeing as a couple. But here's the part. So I thought that was like really bold. I mean, to go away for a whole week in secret like that.
Yeah.
But this is the part that I find fascinating. So 2 days before they were supposed to come back, Dorothy was low on cash. So she pawned $500 worth of her jewelry, which is like tens of thousands of dollars worth of jewelry. Like, that's a lot
then.
Of money,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
For $60 to help pay their expenses. But like, where the hell is Junior's Pittsburgh money during all this?
I don't know.
You know?
I guess maybe his parents cut him off too.
No, because like, he's still with his parents like this whole time. So I have no idea like why she's having to pawn jewelry when she's with this like old, rich, jobless bachelor. I don't know. It's so weird. It just shows you like that at that point in her life, like she's kind of ready to let go of some of the material things, right?
Yeah.
Like that wasn't where her heart was at that moment. She's like, yeah, I'll just pawn some jewelry. Like, who cares? And I think that's telling. Like, I really do. I think that's a very telling action in the story. So that secret Boston getaway would become front page news after her disappearance. But at the time, Dorothy got away with it. She returned to the family's summer home in Maine on September 24th without her parents suspecting a thing. Griscom went back to Pittsburgh and shortly thereafter departed for an extended vacation in Europe with his parents.
Okay, so was that his alibi?
That was his alibi.
Got it.
Monday, December 12th, 1910 was cold and clear in New York City. For Dorothy, it was errand day. She needed a new dress for Marjorie's debutante ball and decided to spend the day shopping. That morning, at around 11 a.m., Dorothy left her home on East 79th Street, telling her mother that she planned to browse the shops along Fifth Avenue. Her mother, Mary, offered to accompany her, but Dorothy insisted she go alone. And apparently this was odd, though, because Mary was, from some of the accounts I read, like almost a shut-in. Like, she didn't go places very often. So it's kind of like weird that she even offered to go with Dorothy at that point. So I think Dorothy probably was not expecting that offer.
Yeah.
But she's like, no. I don't know if I'm going to find anything. But if I do find something, I'll call you. And then, like, you know, you can come look at it or whatever. I think it's the basic gist.
Okay.
Dorothy was dressed elegantly, as one would expect of a young woman of her status stepping out of Manhattan. Later, police would circulate a detailed description of her attire: a tailored navy blue serge suit with a white lace collar, a blue velvet hat adorned with two silk roses, and a fox fur muff to keep her hands warm. Her dark brown hair was styled in a full pompadour under the hat, and she wore tan gloves and carried a small black handbag. She had between $25 and $35 in cash on her, which was a good amount of money in 1910, equivalent to like $800 to $1,000 today. Dorothy appeared cheerful as she set out. Multiple people who saw her that morning later remarked that nothing seemed out of the ordinary with her at all.
Was she walking?
Yes. So I'm going to get to that.
From East 79th Street to 5th?
Dude, well, yeah. So it wasn't so much even just the 5th Avenue part of it. She walked, yeah, west to 5th, but then south like a million blocks, which we're going to get into.
Okay. I mean, the Upper East Side is pretty far away from 5th Avenue.
Especially where she was on 5th. So from her home, she walked west toward 5th Avenue. And despite the fact that it was like really cold and there were patches of ice on the ground, she preferred to walk rather than hire a cab. So apparently walking was something she just liked to do in general. Is, you know, her only form of exercise. She was a walker. Dorothy's first stop was Park and Tilford, an upscale grocery and candy store at 59th and 5th, which was over 20 blocks from her house. She got there around noon and purchased a half-pound box of chocolates. The clerk recognized her as a regular customer, and Dorothy charged the chocolates to the family account. So this is important because, you know, she makes a couple stops but doesn't actually spend any of the money she has on her.
Yeah, it's because she's going to use that money to leave town.
Yeah. From 59th Street, Dorothy continued her last walk downtown. She walked over 30 more blocks down Fifth Avenue. By about 1:45 p.m., she reached Brentano's, a well-known bookstore at 27th and 5th, near Madison Square Park. At Brentano's, Dorothy spent some time browsing the shelves of new fiction. She eventually selected a book of humorous essays called An Engaged Girl's Sketches by Emily Calvin Blake. Like before, Dorothy charged the purchase to her account and had the book wrapped up. Staff at Brentano's later said that Dorothy seemed perfectly cheerful and not at all distressed. As Dorothy stepped out of Brentano's onto busy Fifth Avenue, she quite literally bumped into a friend. This friend was Gladys King, who had attended Bryn Mawr with Dorothy. Gladys was on her way to meet her mother for a late lunch at the Waldorf Astoria and was surprised to see Dorothy downtown. They talked about the upcoming debutante ball for Dorothy's sister, to which Gladys had been invited. And she actually even had her RSVP on her.
Oh.
And she handed it to Dorothy and joked like, hey, you know, it'll save on postage.
Yeah.
To Gladys, Dorothy appeared in excellent spirits. She was smiling and gave no hint of any trouble or secret anxiety. When Gladys excused herself, Dorothy mentioned that she wasn't heading straight home. She said she might take a walk through Central Park before going back to East 79th Street, which makes sense because from where she was on Fifth Avenue downtown, she does pass by Central Park. If she stays on Fifth, you know, she right. would pass right by Central Park on her way back up to her house. So that makes perfect sense. It was now just before 2 p.m. The friends said their goodbyes and Gladys hurried off south toward her lunch while Dorothy walked northward on Fifth Avenue, still carrying her bag of chocolates and the new book under her arm. But that was the last confirmed sighting of Dorothy Arnold. Sometime after 2 p.m. on December 12, 1910, in the heart of Manhattan, the heiress simply vanished. There are no further verified sightings of Dorothy that day. Hey there, I want to take a moment to recommend another podcast called Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse. Mind of a Monster is a podcast series from ID that dives into the minds of notorious serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, and more. This season, they're exploring the chilling story of Kristen Gilbert, a nurse who murders four of her patients between 1989 and 1995, and is suspected of killing dozens more. Criminal psychologist Dr. Michelle Ward takes us inside Kristen's twisted mind, uncovering why she kills and how she manages to do it right in front of her colleagues. The entire season is out now, so you can binge it wherever you get your podcasts. I listened to Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse, and it was really interesting. It's obviously not the type of case that we do on this show, so it was fascinating to get a look into what could cause a person to do something like that. I binged the whole thing too, and now you can listen to Mind of a Monster, The Killer Nurse, wherever you get your podcasts. I didn't know much about money growing up. I got my first job and just kind of spent it. With Acorns Early, your kids don't have to get their money lessons the hard way. Start taking small steps today. Let them learn by doing and watch their potential grow for tomorrow. Because no matter what your kids grow up to be, they're going to have to deal with money, so you might as well start building those skills now. With Acorns Early, they can learn by doing and watch as the small steps they take today grow into big potential for tomorrow. Acorns Early lets kids learn by doing. They can earn money with the in-app chores tracker, practice real-life budgeting with automatic allowances, and even set their own savings goals. We've been using it for our youngest and he loves it. He feels so special having his own debit card, and I can really see him prioritizing the things that he wants to buy. Ready to join over 1.2 million parents and kids who've unlocked their kids' potential with Acorns Early? Get your first month on us when you head to acornsearly.com/ATTWG or download the Acorns Early app. That's 1 month free when you sign up at acornsearly.com/ATTWG.
Acorns Early Card is issued by Community Federal Savings Bank, member FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International. Free trial for new subscribers only. Subscription fee starting from $5 per month unless canceled. Terms apply at acorns.com/early terms.
Did you know that iron deficiency is one of the most common, yet often overlooked, nutritional gaps affecting 1 in 3 adults, especially women? I'm a lifelong vegetarian, and so getting enough iron has been a constant struggle. There are plenty of times when I tried to give blood and I couldn't because my iron was too low, especially in my 20s when my diet consisted of mostly pasta. So I have had to take iron supplements at various times in my life. So when Citerol from PermaNutra wanted to advertise with us, it was a no-brainer. It's a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology, which helps your body absorb 3 to 4 times more iron while avoiding the common side effects of traditional iron supplements like nausea and constipation. It's vegan and gluten-free and 100% allergen-free and free from artificial colorants. So if you feel like no matter how much you rest, you're still running on empty, you're not alone. Over 2 million people have already discovered Citerol, and it could be the support you've been looking for. So head to PharmaNutra-US.com and use code ATTWG for 10% off your first order of Citerol. That's PharmaNutra-US.com, promo code ATTWG for 10% off today.
How close is Grand Central to where she was?
Oh, yeah, pretty close.
Yeah. Saving her money, charging.
Or, I mean, Penn Station. Wait, so Penn Station.
Penn Station.
Yeah, Penn Station.
Sorry.
Because, yeah, she. When did Penn Station open? Hold on. We need to Google this. I'm sure it was open, but I just want to make sure.
Or whatever. I mean, there was definitely a train station.
A train station there. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so I looked it up, and Penn Station had opened like 2 weeks before this.
And it was close, right?
Yeah, it was really close. Definitely on, also on her way back uptown.
That's what I'm saying. I'm thinking she went to Penn Station, bought a train ticket, and left town.
That is so interesting. You're right, because of timing. Like, it had literally just opened. So I wonder if that's why this happened when it did.
Yeah, like, she had planned to leave via the train.
Yeah.
And she was going downtown to Fifth Avenue to shop for the dress, because it was a convenient excuse to get out of the house, and her parents wouldn't think anything of it. And then divert on the way back because she never made it to buy a dress. Right?
Yeah, that's the thing. So nothing I've ever read has said that she ever made it to a dress shop.
Right.
She made it to the bookstore and to the chocolate shop.
Need a book to read on the train.
Yeah.
Then she just diverted and got on a train and probably went to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, but Junior was gone. He was already in Europe at that point.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not like he wasn't coming back.
Yeah. I don't know. All right. Well, we've still got a lot more.
Okay.
But that's interesting. I never even thought of the Penn Station angle. So Dorothy was known to be punctual for family meals because, again, she was outwardly very obedient and doing what she was supposed to do. So by 7 p.m., when she still hadn't returned or sent word, her family grew concerned. Dorothy's father later said that his daughter never stayed out late without permission and would always telephone if she was delayed. So as the hours ticked by, Dorothy's mother, father, brother, and sister grew more and more worried. They decided to take action, but discreetly. The Arnolds were very mindful of their social reputation.
Yeah, therefore not going to the police. And
yep.
Yeah, because word would get out.
Yeah, so like they were absolutely not going to do that on that first night. Instead, they started telephoning Dorothy's friends one by one, hoping that someone had seen her. Each call, though, came up empty. None of Dorothy's close friends knew where she was. And so when they called the friends, they're like, okay, well, that's fine. Don't tell anybody about this call.
Yeah.
Sometime after midnight, Elsie Henry, one of the friends they had contacted, called back to see if Dorothy had turned up. So Dorothy's mother, Mary, answered the phone. When Elsie asked if Dorothy was home, Mary lied and said, yes, she's here. Elsie asked if she could speak with Dorothy, but Mary told her she's very tired. She's gone to bed with a headache. And quickly ended the call. So, I mean, that's how much they value their privacy and their reputation. They had no idea where Dorothy was, but they were covering that up. The next morning, December 13th, the Arnold family decided that they would stay on that path. They weren't going to report Dorothy missing to the police. Now, this obviously sounds insane just in the context of the other 200 plus episodes that we've done.
Well, it was a different time.
Yeah. But also, the Arnolds did have some kind of legitimate reasons. So just a year earlier in 1909, another prominent Manhattan family had endured a nightmare with their 13-year-old daughter, Adele Boas. So she disappeared from Central Park. But the Boas girl turned out to have run away to Boston and was eventually found unharmed, but the newspapers had a field day with it. The Boases were ridiculed and shamed in the press for losing their daughter.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
Yeah. So the Arnolds decided that if Dorothy had simply taken an unannounced trip or done something impulsive, it would be far better to handle it quietly than to ignite a media circus that could tarnish the family name. So instead of calling the NYPD, the Arnolds initiated a private search. Dorothy's older brother, John, swung into action. He reached out to a trusted family friend, John S. Keith, a young lawyer, and asked him to come to the house immediately. Keith arrived at the Arnold mansion on the morning of December 13th and was ushered upstairs to Dorothy's bedroom, which was, you know, the last place she had been before leaving. Keith conducted what amounted to an amateur investigation of Dorothy's room, looking for any signs of where she might have gone. But the room was in perfect order. There were no signs of packing and nothing appeared to be missing. This told them that Dorothy hadn't secretly moved out or taken a trunk of belongings. Wherever she was, she had only the clothes on her back. Interestingly, on Dorothy's desk, Keith discovered two ocean liner brochures and some letters with foreign postmarks. The brochures were for transatlantic steamships, but there was no booking or ticket that they could find. So they didn't know if the pamphlets represented an actual plan or just, you know, dreams of future travel.
Or a plan to travel to Europe to meet up with her boyfriend.
Yeah. Then Keith made a more ominous find. Kneeling by the fireplace, he noticed a small mound of burnt paper among the ashes. He carefully sifted through the charred fragments, but the pages were too damaged to read. When he mentioned it, Dorothy's brother John speculated that they might be the remnants of Dorothy's rejected short stories. And, you know, it could have been. Maybe she wanted to burn the evidence of her failures. Or
letters from her boyfriend.
Yeah, it could have been something else she wanted to hide.
Right.
Despite the fact that he was a lawyer and not a detective, John Keith took the lead on the investigation. He advised the Arnolds to keep the situation quiet and allow him to make discreet inquiries. That very day and in the weeks that followed, Keith scoured the city for any sign of Dorothy. He checked hospitals, jails, and morgues in New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, but absolutely nothing turned up. Keith's search was coming up empty, and the family was growing increasingly frantic. After several fruitless weeks.
Still not reporting this to the police.
No. John Keith realized that they needed professional help, but not the police. He recommended that Francis Arnold bring in the Pinkerton Detective Agency, the most famous private investigators of the day. Francis agreed. So the Pinkertons were briefed on everything that the family knew. The detectives had a broadside circular printed up with Dorothy's photograph, physical description, and the offer of a reward, which was initially $1,000, which I want to say was something like $35,000 in today's money, give or take. These descriptions of the missing heiress were sent to police departments and Pinkerton agents nationwide. But despite all of this effort, the Arnolds still had not officially notified the New York City Police Department itself. The Pinkerton agency mailed a circular to the NYPD as they did to others, but the local police would not act on a missing persons case unless the family formally requested it. And so, through December 1910 and into early January, a wealthy family hunted desperately for their missing daughter while the city police remained largely unaware that any of it was even happening.
Wow.
It wasn't until 6 weeks after Dorothy vanished in late January 1911 that the Arnold family finally broke their silence and went to the authorities. All of the family's private efforts had led nowhere. Pinkerton detectives had chased down every lead they could think of. They scoured Dorothy's favorite spots, inquired with her acquaintances, and even checked outbound passenger lists for steamships on the chance that Dorothy might have escaped to Europe.
But did they check the trains?
I didn't read anything about them checking trains, but they did check marriage records, fearing that she might have secretly married someone, but they didn't have any luck there either. Wherever Dorothy was, she left no paper trail and no witnesses. On January 22nd, 1911, Francis Arnold, along with Keith and a Pinkerton agent, finally met with Deputy Police Commissioner William J. Flynn. Upon hearing the incredible story, Deputy Commissioner Flynn strongly urged a public appeal for help. He told them that they needed to publicize Dorothy's disappearance in order to generate new leads. And this was, of course, exactly what Francis Arnold had feared most, making a spectacle in the press.
Right.
He didn't want to do it. According to later accounts, it took 2 days of intense argument to persuade him that it was the only way they were going to get answers. So finally, he agreed. On January 25th, 1911, New York's press corps were summoned to Francis Arnold's downtown office for a news conference. Wasting no time, Francis delivered a shocking opening statement. He announced that his beloved daughter Dorothy was missing and was very likely dead.
No, what?
Yes. So the reporters were stunned. Not only was this the first they'd heard of a prominent young woman vanishing, but the girl's own father was just up there saying that she'd been killed.
With no evidence.
Yeah. So he went on to explain his personal theory, which he had evidently been harboring for weeks. If Dorothy had walked home via Central Park, she could have taken the path by the reservoir. He went on saying, quote, "There, because of the laxity of police supervision over the park, I believe it quite possible that she might have been murdered by garroters and her body thrown into the lake of the reservoir. Such atrocious things do happen, though there seems to be no justification for them," end quote.
The hell is a garrotter?
So, I mean, I think I know what a garrote is, you know, which is a tool that you use to strangle somebody.
Oh.
So I've never heard it used as a verb before or like to describe a person. But yeah, basically they're saying she was attacked on the park and strangled because the cops suck at their jobs and don't patrol the park very well.
Well, it's also convenient for him to say that because then it kind of wraps up like the potential for public
scandal.
Yeah, no, more so like the press, like what happened to the other family.
Oh, like blaming them for her being lost.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it does. Right. And it also makes him look maybe a little less bad for keeping it under wraps for so long, because if he had believed the entire time she was dead.
Right.
Then like, did they really need to go to the press before this?
Right.
You know, yeah. I don't know. So the NYPD, for their part, they were skeptical of Francis's theory. Central Park's reservoir was frozen on the day that Dorothy vanished, so no one could have easily sunk a body there on December 12th, 1910. Still, later in the springtime, once the ice thawed, police did drag the reservoir, but found nothing.
It's because she was in Pittsburgh.
So apparently from the old articles and stuff I was reading, it seemed kind of funny because from the descriptions of this press conference, Francis got up there and he's, again, this like hugely powerful man in New York City. So he gets up in front of all these reporters. And he's like, hey, my daughter's been missing for 6 weeks. She's dead. The police suck. She was strangled. She's in the reservoir. Anyway, if anybody has any info, like, give it to me. And he was like, that's the end of the press conference. He was ready to be like, okay, so thanks, bye.
No questions.
Yeah. But then the reporters are like, wait, we have a million questions. Number one, what? And so apparently Francis was like very irritated by the entire thing. So one reporter boldly asked if Mr. Arnold had objected to his daughter, quote, keeping company with men. Because basically, he had described his daughter as like this very boring, obedient person. And so right. The reporters are like, come on, like there has to be more to her than that.
Well, there was.
Exactly. And the reporters immediately knew it. So they're like, OK, well, tell us about like boyfriends. Like, did you object to her having one? Could she have, you know, run off, basically, is what they were asking. They wanted to know if there was perhaps a romantic angle to Dorothy's disappearance. But that question touched a nerve. Francis Arnold very snippily told the reporter, quote, it is not true that I objected to her having men call. In fact, he insisted, quote, I would have been glad to see her associate more with young men than she did, especially some young men of brains and position, one whose profession or business would keep him occupied. I don't approve of young men who have nothing to do, end quote.
Or old men that have nothing to
exactly,
do.
Exactly, right? So the reporters instantly sensed a story there.
Yeah.
Young men who have nothing to do clearly alluded to someone specific in Dorothy's life. Within hours, the press would uncover that Francis Arnold was referring to none other than George Griscom Jr., and the media latched on to that angle. After all, an heiress disappearing is intriguing enough, but an heiress possibly running off with a mysterious older man, like that was a headline.
Yeah.
Dorothy's case was front page news across the country by the next morning. The disappearance of Dorothy Arnold quickly became a media sensation. Newspapers from coast to coast printed daily updates on the case. Some were factual, but many were wildly speculative. New York papers in particular devoted extensive coverage, often on the front page, to the latest rumors and leads. The New York Times ran stories on Dorothy nearly every day following the press conference. Tabloids like the Evening World and New York Journal tried to outdo each other with eye-catching headlines and even illustrations. The public was equally transfixed. Here was a beautiful, educated heiress from high society who had evaporated in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue. It was a real-life mystery novel unfolding in the headlines. And because Dorothy was wealthy and well-connected, the case drew far more attention than the typical missing person of the era. Police in New York and beyond were flooded with leads. Commissioner Rhinelander Waldo had thousands of reward posters and bulletins distributed across the country from New York City to Canada and even Mexico. The story of Griscom and the secret Boston trip came out, and papers questioned if Dorothy had run off with him for good. And if she had, was she still with him, Or had a lover's quarrel led to her remaining missing?
Mm.
So, of course, George Griscom Jr. had to be looked into. Now, as we kind of talked about earlier, when she vanished, he was thousands of miles away in Europe.
Conveniently,
in Florence, Italy, specifically. On December 16th, just days after Dorothy disappeared, the Arnold family had quietly sent him a telegram in Europe that said, quote, Dorothy Arnold missing, family prostrated, cable Garvarmcom, which I think is just a place that he could send the message, if you know anything of her whereabouts, end quote. Griscom immediately replied with a cable saying, quote, no, absolutely nothing, Junior, end quote.
Okay. No sense of, well, I mean.
It's a cable, yeah. And, you know, you have to pay by the letter. Right. So, yeah, I think you got to keep it short and to the point.
Yeah.
When reporters eventually tracked him down, Junior professed his innocence. He claimed that he hadn't seen Dorothy since early November and had no idea what could have happened to her. Once he returned to the U.S., Junior tried to rehabilitate his image in the press. He proclaimed that if Dorothy were found, he intended to marry her, provided that her mother consented. But Mary was clear that she would not.
Jeez.
Meanwhile, Griscom did something rather public. He spent thousands of dollars taking out large advertisements in major newspapers addressed directly to Dorothy, begging her to contact him or come home. These notices, signed Junior, implored Dorothy to let him know that she was safe. Whether this was a genuine gesture of concern or whether he was just kind of being performative, who knows? But in either case, Dorothy never responded. By the end of January 1911, the official stance of law enforcement was pessimistic. Deputy Commissioner Flynn told reporters, quote, that now seems the only reasonable way of looking at the case. The girl has now been missing for 75 days, and in all that time, not a single clue has been found that was worth the name. We have no evidence that a crime has been committed, and the case is now one of a missing person and nothing more, end quote. The search wouldn't stop, he ensured them, but police were scaling back the assumption of foul play. So, yeah, he thought that she just ran off he didn't think that she had been murdered. The Arnold family remained split on what they thought happened. Despite the myriad rumors already swirling, Francis doubled down on his belief that Dorothy had been attacked and killed on day one. He told reporters that he had believed that from the very start. In contrast, some of Dorothy's friends and extended family quietly began to suspect a different tragedy, that Dorothy might have taken her own life in despair. Now, there was no proof of that either, but certain clues pointed to that direction, especially once they dug deeper into Dorothy's state of mind in late 1910. As winter turned to spring of 1911, with still no trace of Dorothy, just about every conceivable theory was put forward in newspapers or by supposed informants. So let's talk about all of them. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. If you're like me, then you have different family members who have different ailments, and I've recommended Mood to all of them. I legitimately, before recording this, I told my mom about Mood, and she's going to make her first order. Because they have gummies for all sorts of things, for pain relief, for sleeping, for just improving your mood. Their gummies are specially blended and each one feels different. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I wake up feeling amazing. And each gummy is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. This holiday season, comfort is slowing down and finding calm amidst the chaos. As the holidays fill up with gatherings, travel, and to-do lists, Avocado Green Mattress helps you create a space that's calm, cozy, and restorative. Avocado products transform your home into a peaceful, grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. But more importantly, they offer unmatched comfort. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. And every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and the quality you're bringing into your home. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado. Dream of better. If you've been listening to this show for a while, then you know that I'm a podcaster and a realtor. And on some days, like today, I have to do both. I spent all day in a courthouse watching a trial that we're covering, and then I had to drive an hour and a half away to put a lockbox on a new listing. It was a long day, to say the least, and normally I would have been exhausted at about 3 when I still had several hours to go. But I've recently been adding everyday dose into my morning routine, specifically into my morning coffee. And let me tell you, I was driving home late tonight and I felt great. Everyday Dose is coffee plus benefits. They combine high quality coffee with powerful ingredients like lion's mane and chaga, collagen protein, and nootropics to fuel your brain, boost focus, and give you clean, sustained energy all day long. It tastes just like coffee without the downside. No crash, no jitters, just clean, sustained energy. Right now for Black Friday, get 61% off your first Coffee Plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/ATTWG or use code ATTWG at checkout. We'll talk about your theory first, that she ran off to start a new life.
Okay.
It became pretty clear after her story remained public that she didn't run off with Griscom.
Sure.
Because he was still with his parents. Dorothy had not been seen anywhere around Florence. He came back to the States. Dorothy was still nowhere to be seen. Like, she wasn't with him. Now, of course, there was, you know, that the sub theory of this was that she had run away, but like maybe he killed her or something.
Oh, I don't think that.
I mean, that just kind of got brought up like whatever. But I also don't think that's what happened. So we know that she wasn't with Junior, but there was speculation that perhaps there was another lover that her family didn't know about and she could possibly be with him. You know, another theory is that maybe it wasn't about a man at all. Maybe she had just run away to write under a pen name. So they thought perhaps she could have gone to Europe to write under a pen name. And, you know, they pointed to those brochures that they had found in her room. But beyond Europe, back in the States, sightings had also come in from all over the country. She was allegedly seen in Philadelphia, then spotted in a small town in Oklahoma, then in San Antonio. But of course, none of those were ever confirmed.
Mm.
But of course, the Arnold family did not believe this is what happened to her at all. They said she didn't take money. She didn't take luggage. Like, there's no way.
I mean, she had some money on her.
She had some money on her. And she, you know, I don't know a lot about the jewelry she was wearing. I saw something that she was wearing drop earrings. They were gemstone. They weren't diamonds. I have no idea how much money she could have gotten from those, but we do know that she's not above pawning jewelry in a pinch.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like the hat and the fox muff.
I was just going to say the clothing and accessories.
Those are things that I think she probably could have sold and gotten a fair amount of money from.
Yeah.
Like, apparently that hat, you know, with the silk roses, like, was quite an expensive item. And, you know, the fact that she was never found kind of points to that. And it was 1910, you know, there weren't photo IDs. Like,
yeah,
it was fairly easy to just make up a new name and just start over somewhere.
Right. Any identification is all handwritten at that point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could very easily completely change your identity and create a new life somewhere else.
Exactly. So let's say she just did that and stayed in the States or even went to Europe, but like she did it with a new name. Like, let's say her new name, Carol Smith, right? So eventually when she dies, Carol Smith dies.
Right.
There's a grave under Carol Smith's name.
Yeah.
I can totally see that happening at this point in history, you know? And she proved herself to be resourceful and not afraid of adventure. Like that secret Boston trip where she's pawning jewelry and stuff is pretty wild.
That's what I'm saying. Like this is all of the evidence points to her bailing on her life. Like,
yeah. And I do. And, you know, that's so funny that you brought up the book on the train because I hadn't thought of the train, but you're right. Like if I were getting ready to go on a train trip, a box of chocolates and a book.
Got to read something on that train.
Right. Yeah. And have a little snack.
Yeah.
I can completely see that. But of course, that is not the only theory. There was, of course, her father's theory, which was a random abduction or murder. But as I mentioned, his whole Central Park attack theory was not one that the police believed. And it just was unlikely. Again, it was like broad daylight. Yeah. Yes, Central Park had crime, but I mean, that was a little crazy. And the idea that like nobody would have seen it, no trace of her would have ever come up.
There's no evidence at all.
Yeah. Like none of her items were found in local pawn shops, you know, anything like that. It just seems unlikely that she could have encountered a murderer on a frozen path who killed her without leaving a trace. But we can't fully rule out a non-random foul play scenario. Could somebody who knew Dorothy but wasn't on the family's radar have lured her out that afternoon? Maybe there was an acquaintance or a suitor who met her after Gladys King left. And then something happened to her from there. So, like, I mean, I think that's slightly maybe more likely than just a stranger, but like...
I guess, but what would be the point?
Exactly, yeah. And it's the same
again,
thing.
And again, there's...
No trace of her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, another theory is that Dorothy ended her own life. Junior himself was an early proponent of the suicide idea. He told a reporter that Dorothy had been very upset over her writing failures and that he feared she might have taken her own life out of depression. In fact, one of Dorothy's last letters to Junior, which she wrote around Thanksgiving 1910, was pretty revealing. In it, she said, quote, McClure's has turned me down. Failure stares me in the face. All I can see ahead is a long road with no turning, end quote. Which, I mean, she seems like a pretty good writer.
Yeah. My only issue with suicide.
But wait. Okay, Hold on. Because there's one more line in the letter.
Okay.
Quote, mother will always think an accident has happened, end quote.
That line is out of the blue like that?
I mean, it's in that same letter. I don't know.
Like, where's the context?
There? I don't know. It was just, I don't have the full letter, just those two excerpts.
Hmm.
But you can see that could sound like somebody who might consider suicide, but wants her mother to believe it was an accident, maybe just, you know, spare the pain or the scandal.
Sure. Where's her body then?
Okay. Yes, because obviously that is the main problem. Because if Dorothy had jumped into a river or the harbor, you would expect her body to wash ashore eventually, but nothing surfaced. Now, there was a possibility that Dorothy could have taken a ferry or ship and went overboard in a place where records wouldn't be kept. So, for example, the Fall River Line steamship left New York each evening and allowed passengers to travel anonymously. So perhaps she did end her own life, but it was just farther away, and the body was never connected to her.
But nobody saw her jump from this ferry?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are a fair number of people who just go overboard without others noticing.
I guess.
Like, I covered another one on Day by Day. Like, nobody saw it. They just found his coat folded neatly by the railing.
Mm. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But I absolutely can see just because of, again, the time and even up until like the 1970s, 80s, like if you died in another state, it was very hard. And, you know, nobody knew who you were in that state. Like it was really hard to connect you to a missing person in a different state. Like, so she did go somewhere else outside of Manhattan to kill herself. Like, I can see the possibility that there would be a body out there that just would not be identified as her.
But even after all of the publicity, though.
Yeah, I don't know. And that is a good point, because it was nationwide news. So, yeah, you would think that, like, if a body turned up in Jersey or, like, Philadelphia or somewhere, that maybe somebody would have put two and two together. But maybe not. Like, it's hard to say. But I for that reason, like, I wouldn't completely rule it out. Then there is the botched surgery theory, a.k.a. illegal abortion. In this theory, Dorothy died during a botched illegal abortion and her body was hidden to cover it up. There were underground abortion providers in those days, and the procedures were often dangerous. Now, this theory gained traction in the years after her disappearance due to a couple of intriguing developments. In April 1914, over 3 years after Dorothy vanished, police in Pittsburgh raided a clandestine clinic operating out of a home in Bellevue, Pennsylvania. This place was run by a man named Dr. C.C. Meredith. His home was nicknamed the House of Mystery because multiple women had gone missing after last being seen there. During the raid, police found an operating table and two furnaces in the basement.
Ugh.
Yeah. One of the doctors arrested, a Dr. H.E. Lutz, made a statement to investigators that set off shockwaves. Lutz claimed that Dr. Meredith confided in him that Dorothy Arnold had died at that clinic during an abortion procedure and that her body was cremated in the furnace.
Well, there you go.
I mean, yeah, like, and that's so hard because it's completely plausible. There's the Pittsburgh connection.
Yep.
She had the secret relationship, and there's no way to prove it or disprove it.
Yeah.
So, obviously, that was a bombshell allegation. The New York County District Attorney at the time, Charles Whitman, reportedly found Lutz's testimony credible enough to investigate. But, unfortunately, they couldn't really find any hard evidence beyond Lutz's word. And Dr. Meredith denied the story.
Mm.
So, yeah, like, I don't know. Francis Arnold, when asked about this in 1914, was livid and dismissive. He called the tale ridiculous and absolutely untrue.
Well, because it would tarnish his name.
Exactly. Yeah, that's like the last thing he would want to happen. He'd rather have his daughter, you know, murdered by garroters in Central Park.
Yeah.
Than dying in a botched abortion in Pittsburgh.
Right.
But the abortion theory didn't die there. In 1916, another piece of alleged evidence surfaced via an unlikely source, a career criminal in Rhode Island. In April of that year, 5.5 years after Dorothy vanished, a man named Edward Glenn Norris, who was in prison for extortion, came forward with a startling confession. He told a warden an elaborate story in which he claimed to have participated in disposing of Dorothy Arnold's body in December 1910. According to him, he was paid $250 by an associate known only as Little Louie, to help drive a young unconscious woman from a house in New Rochelle, New York, to a location in Weehawken, New Jersey. There, a doctor informed them that the woman had died during an operation and the body needed to be disposed of. Glenn Norris claimed that they took the woman's body back to a cellar of a house in New Rochelle and buried her there. He further claimed that the woman was Dorothy Arnold. He recognized her and he noticed a signet ring on her finger that matched one known to belong to Dorothy. Now, for a moment, this seemed like it could be the truth. Authorities took Glenn Norris's story seriously enough to excavate several cellars in New Rochelle looking for remains, but nothing was found. And when police tried to get more details from Glenn Norris later, he became evasive and acted confused, basically recanting his confession.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite possible that he made the whole thing up for attention or in hopes of leniency for his own crimes. Or maybe there was a little bit of truth to it. Maybe he had heard jailhouse rumors about Dorothy's fate and embellished them. Either way, no physical evidence ever corroborated his tale. Years went by and Dorothy Arnold never returned. The Arnold family's life was never the same. Francis Arnold, who had spent what was reported as a staggering $250,000, which is millions of dollars, of his fortune on the feudal search, became a bitter, grief-stricken man. He died in 1922, having never learned of his daughter's fate. In his will, he pointedly made no provision for Dorothy, stating that he was, quote, satisfied that she is not alive, end quote. Dorothy's mother, Mary Arnold, lived longer. She did not believe that her daughter had been murdered. By most accounts, she clung to the hope that Dorothy was still alive somewhere, perhaps with amnesia in a hospital or living quietly under another name, but alive. Mary kept the faith until the end of her life. She passed away in December 1928, 18 years after Dorothy vanished. John Keith, the family friend turned investigator, outlived them and eventually voiced his own conclusion. In the wake of Mary's death, Keith publicly stated that he believed Dorothy had died by suicide due to her failed writing career. But again, it was only a theory. Even today, 115 years later, Dorothy Arnold's fate remains unknown. The case stands as a true crime legend. Was Dorothy a victim of her circumstances or the architect of her own vanishing act?
What happened with Junior?
I don't know. He just like went on and lived his life.
Wonder if he ever got married and had kids.
Ooh, I don't know. Let's see. Okay, so I found his obituary, which really was just the information about his death. So he died in 1938 at the age of 67 in England. But I don't see any wife or kids or anything listed. It just says that his family was his parents and his brother.
Okay. But he did go back to Europe.
He did go back to Europe. I don't know.
Just saying. Yeah. There might be something there.
I don't know. So what do you think? Like, do you think that she ran off and ended up in Europe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It's like you said, there's no evidence that she ended up with Junior.
Right.
But, you know, where else would she go? Or she went off and actually had a successful writing career under a pen name.
Yeah.
I would be curious, and this is a much deeper dive. I'm sure somebody has already done this, like looked into famous female authors that emerged
that could possibly be her
after
that, like,
her disappearance.
Yeah, who maybe have, you know, her
similar writing style, or maybe even look a little bit like her.
Yeah.
Because there are pictures of her.
Yeah, there are pictures of her. Plenty of them.
I'd be curious if there was any theories on that.
I don't know. Nothing that I ran into. But I do find that interesting. But, you know, maybe she didn't become famous, right? Like,
yeah.
Maybe she toiled away. Maybe it never did work out for her. Maybe she just married somebody and just lived a life.
Yeah, maybe she just wanted to get away from a very oppressive father.
Yeah.
A very oppressive and controlling father.
Right.
And like you stated or pointed out, obviously materialistic things were not really, didn't really matter that much to her.
Yeah, and I think that at that time, you could find an artist community, whether it's in Greenwich Village like she wanted, or in Paris, or something like that, and live for dirt cheap.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the money, the items she had on her might have been enough for her to, like, start over very modestly somewhere.
Right.
You know? And, hey, listen, we don't know. Like, maybe she and Griscom didn't end up together, but maybe he helped her out somehow. Like, maybe he was able to see her and give her money at some point, or something like that, you know? We don't know. Like, there could have been somebody out there, even if it wasn't him, who helped her in this. And, like, honestly, I want to believe that because it's the holidays.
We want a happy missing person's
case. You know what
case?
I mean? Because legitimately, like, going through all the theories, I'm less inclined to believe the suicide one.
Yeah.
And honestly, part of that is because of the book and the box of chocolates. Like, the chocolates, sure, but, like, are you going to buy a book you're not going to read? Like, what's the point of that?
Yeah.
You know?
And again, we've gone down the rabbit hole of murder and her not being found.
Yeah, I don't believe that. And even with, the suicide, the murder, I don't necessarily believe that. To me, I think the two ones that are viable are she did run off to start a new life, or the botched abortion, especially the Pittsburgh one specifically.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Because the
but you would also but you would also think if she was about to take a secret trip to Pittsburgh, like her friend even pointed out that she seemed not distressed at all.
Yeah,
perfectly fine.
Yeah, not nervous.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a good point too. Like, yeah, I mean, if she were running off to Pittsburgh to have an abortion, you would think she would have come up with a better cover story.
Right.
Because she would have had to have been gone at the very least overnight.
Yeah.
If not for a few days. And so, like, telling her parents she's going off to buy a dress isn't nearly as good of a cover story of, hey, I'm going to visit my college girlfriend in Cambridge, but I'm actually sneaking off to Boston with my boyfriend.
Yeah.
Like, that makes sense. Like, that's a good cover story.
Right.
Buying a dress and then fucking off to Pittsburgh for a couple of days, like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So I want to use that as proof that that's not what she did, because, like, that's tragic. That's awful that, you know, abortion, when it's not legal, is unsafe, and people still get abortions, and often it just ends up going very badly for everyone. So I'm hoping that the fact that the cover story was just an afternoon shopping trip means that that wasn't the plan. Because, you know, if your plan is to never come back, you don't need to come up with a good cover story.
Right. You just need to make sure that you're covered for the time
that it takes you to get away.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it doesn't matter. But yeah, but if it was Pittsburgh, you would think that she would be planning on coming back afterwards. So you would need a better cover story.
Yeah. And she obviously had thought things out like that because she had done it in Boston.
Exactly. She was smart. She was resourceful.
Right.
Like, you're right. She wouldn't have just. And again, an abortion in Pittsburgh, like, that's not a spur of the moment decision.
Right.
Like, you can't just Google fucking House of Mystery in Pittsburgh. Like,
you probably could now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But like,
but not in 1910.
But not in 1910. You know what I mean? Like, it would have taken a lot of research, a lot of planning in order to do that.
Right. And even if it wasn't Pittsburgh, because there was the other.
The New Rochelle one. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
still,
it's still a surgery. Like,
New
it's
Rochelle
not, you're not gonna...
is not close to New York City. Like, those are both, I mean, it's closer than Pittsburgh, but still, like, this is not a day trip.
Any abortion is going to be an overnight trip because you have to recover from the surgery.
Exactly.
So, like,
yeah,
it's like you said, that like, there would have been a greater cover story for that time being gone.
Right.
Unless, like you said, you purposely went off to start a new life, then it doesn't matter.
Then it doesn't matter. You just needed to find an excuse to get out of the house that day.
And she did. And she even told her mom, no, no, no.
Don't come with me.
Don't come with me.
Yeah. I'll see you later. Okay, that's it. I'm believing that's what happened. Because again, it's the holidays. And I just want her to have gone off of her own volition and live some sort of a happy life. Whether that was with a secret lover, whether it was with as a writer, whether it was both, whether it was neither, like, whatever. Like, I hope that she went out and just did what she wanted to do. And that, you know, Carol Smith or whatever is buried out there and was loved and was happy before her death. Regardless of what did happen to her, what we do know is that in disappearing, Dorothy Arnold, ironically, achieved a measure of the fame she sought in life. She never became a celebrated writer, at least not under that name, but she became an infamous missing person, a character in her own real-life mystery that outlived everyone involved. Thank you for joining us this week for our last new episode of 2025. We appreciate each and every one of you who tunes in every week. We want to wish you all a safe and happy holiday season and a happy new year.
Happy holidays.
You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next year for a brand new episode.
See you next year.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.